Okay, so this is what we'll do. We'll get everybody out on time. So if you're starting this coming Shabbos through Purim, so there's a number of mitzvos to think about. So we have, obviously, this week Parshas Zachar, which I'll talk about just one aspect of it. Then we have Tanit Esther the day before Purim. Then on Purim, we know we have Mikra Megillah. We have Matanos Avionim, Mishloach Manot, and the Su'uda. And those are essentially the mitzvot. Again, there are other customs. We mentioned Machatzit HaShekel, which can be done. This is the time period we do it. It's really a minhag. It can be done. Some people do it on Tanis Esther. Some people do it Purim morning itself. So the handout that I gave you, which I'm only going to refer to a little bit, this is just a good overview of all the laws of Purim in English, you know, more or less. So a good quick review. Cheat sheet. So what I want to do is as follows. When it comes to Parashat Zachor, so there's really one question I just want to throw out there. There is a bit of a debate amongst the poskim whether or not women are obligated in Parashat Zachor. I'm not going to go through the whole debate. The custom in most places is that women do go to hear Parashat Zachor, and we assume that women are obligated in Parashat Zachor. So that's the custom in most places. We're going to just grab one of those sheets. We're going to refer to it a couple times. So again, I don't want to. There's a debate whether women are obligated or not. That's a topic for another time. The one point that people often make a mistake, which is the only point I wanted to correct, is when people talk about this topic, sometimes they say, oh, well, the reason in some places women aren't so machbid about it and they don't think that they're obligated is because it's a mitzvah seishas man grama. Right? It's a time-bound mitzvah, and we know that normally women are exempt from time-bound mitzvah. So I just want to put that to bed, that that's totally incorrect. Right? The mitzvah of Parshas Zachor is not a mitzvah seishas man grama. Well, you'll tell me, why not? We do it every year the week before Purim, right? So it should sound like it's a man grama. So the answer is no. There's a biblical obligation to remember what Amalek did to us when we left Mitzrayim. It happens to be, Chazal told us that the best place to do that happens to be around Purim. But if we were to read Parshat Zachar, right, any other time, right, in fact, when it gets repeated in Sefer Devarim, some say if you had it, like if you missed, I don't know, you were sick or you were sleeping through Purim, and you have it in mind when they read it, then you'd be Yotzei too. Meaning, the mitzvah is an individual mitzvah to remember what was done to us. Again, the way Chazal told us we fulfill it is through the reading of Parshas Zachor the week before Purim, but that's not really the Torah obligation. The Torah obligation is at some point in the year we do it. So all I'm pointing out here is that it is not a mitzvah seishas man grama, that's for sure. Again, whether or not women are obligated is a separate debate, but as I said, the most poskim assume that women are obligated in Parshas Zachor, and that's why for those of you who have been cooped up all winter long or didn't make it to shul for that time, the minhag in Klal Yisrael is that women make sure that they get to shul to hear Parshat Zachar. Some shuls are nice and they do a reading at the end of davening again for those people who couldn't get there or young children, whatever it might be. Fine, so that's Parshat Zachar. That's the only point I'll say in Parshat Zachar. When it comes to Tanis Esther, so I just want to point out a couple of things. And this is just one of these things, having taught high school students for so long, it's like one of these things that I can't go without speaking about. So there's this phrase out there in the world that's really in English words. I don't know exactly, I don't think there is a Hebrew equivalent, that we refer to these minor fasts. And therefore, for some reason, people think that, well, they're minor, so we don't have to worry about them. So typically, the minor fasts refer to basically everything but Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, right? That's what people say. We have the four fast days plus the fifth one being Tanis Esther are quote-unquote viewed as minor. And the truth is, they are viewed as minor in comparison to to Tisha B'Av and to Yom Kippur. But the halacha is that everybody who is otherwise healthy or not pregnant or nursing or, you know, if you don't fast well, you get headaches very often. So there might be more leniencies for people to not fast on these days as opposed to Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, but it shouldn't be viewed as a blanket, we don't fast. In fact, typically speaking, you know, the the poskim talk about the idea of a woman who's pregnant or nursing, right? The big question that's brought up, which is, you know, interesting conversation, which I think is only more recent, what about a woman who isn't nursing, but shortly after, and I don't mean like a few days or weeks, so like I know Rabbi Willig was always of the opinion that it didn't have to do so much with actually nursing, but it had to do with like kind of recovering from the whole childbirth. So he said for the 2 years after giving birth, whether you're nursing or not, you don't have to fast on these minor fast days. So, you know, it's a joke, but it's not a joke. That, you know, sometimes you find more women that don't fast in the more like Haredi type of communities. And like sometimes we look at that as like, well, if they're not fasting, why do we have to, like, why would, like, it must be there's something minor about it. And unfortunately, that's not the case. It's just, you know, perhaps, you know, there's just, you know, between being nursing and pregnant and 2 years afterwards, so there's a lot of that. So whatever it might be, the point that I'm trying to make is that we shouldn't take Tanis Esther or any of the other quote-unquote minor fasts as if that they don't exist. And again, assuming we don't have a medical reason, which, again, if we do, then that's a different story. Everybody should be fasting. The only point, again, we're just as we walked in, we were kind of going through and touching on, and then I'm going to spend a little more time on a few of the last mitzvot. The first of Parsha Zachar, we started with this Tanis Esther. When it comes to Mikra Megillah, so that we can talk about, and I don't mean like the story of the Megillah, but just the halacha of the Megillah. So again, in your packets, there's, I think, a pretty good shortened details of the things that are just important to remember. So again, just from experience, I would take advantage of these packets because it's short, but it covers the main things that you need to really focus on. The one idea that I just wanted to share about the Megillah in itself really is more of a hashkafic idea, as my Rebbe always would talk about around this time of the year. And he always talked about that the whole idea of Purim and the story of the Megillah is the biggest proof to the concept, which unfortunately our generation does not appreciate as much, perhaps, as previous generations, of the idea of emunas chachamim, of believing in our chachamim and knowing that they know something that we may not know, and what that means. And if you could kind of put yourself into what it would have felt like to be a Jew in the times of Mordechai and Esther, right? And you see that, you know, all Haman asks Mordechai to do is a simple bow down. He'll forget about it. He could pretend. He doesn't have to mean it in any way, right? The post can talk about he wouldn't have been violating Avodah Zarah. He wouldn't have been violating any crazy huge Averot by doing it because he wouldn't have been having the Kavanah and so on. So that's a big conversation. But nevertheless, he said he's not doing it. Most of us would have thought he was crazy if we were sitting there at the time. And we would have thought, like, you know, you're going to put all the Jews' lives in danger because of it. Right? And, you know, we could further that out. But the point being that, you know, the normal human response would have been that was wrong. And yet we know that it was right. So Rav Dessler talks about this in Michtav Eliyahu at length, as this as being one of his, you know, big places in Tanakh where he talks about this concept of, you know, again, we don't know who those chacham necessarily are, but typically, you know, when it comes to generational, you know, gedolim, those are things that people just kind of know, right? That's the difference between Jews and non-Jews, right? By the non-Jews, right, if you're a big person in the community, you get up and you tell everyone you're the big person in the community. Whereas the biggest rabbis, usually the way they become big is when everybody else tells them to go to seek them out. They're not the ones being sought out. But anyway, that's one idea. Now, let's focus in on, because that's really the thing I wanted to focus mostly on, the mitzvot of matanot l'avyonim, mishloach matot, and su'udat Purim. So the truth is, if you want to know the halachot of Purim and their origin, just read it's Perek Tet, it's not the last Perek, because Perek Yud is a short Perek at the end of the Megillah, but Perek Tet really is the kind of the end of the story and goes through many of the things. So there in Pasuk Yud Tet and Chaf Bet, we see the idea. I'll just read Chaf Bet. It says, "Kayamim ashanachu behem ayehudim ayveim." Right, they finally were done with their enemies. V'hachodesh asher ne'apachu hem miyagon l'simcha. It got turned, you know, from a time of worry to simcha u'me'evel l'yam tov. V'aso so some, so that we should make these days yimei mishta v'simcha. So that's really those three mitzvot. They may be a mishta v'simcha, a day of drinking, well, it doesn't say drinking literally, but the day of, you know, feasting and simcha, shalach manos, and matanos le'avionim. Again, not for now, but this is often viewed as one of the big distinctions between Purim and Hanukkah, which are the two rabbinic holidays that got added on afterwards. Hanukkah was more the threat of our religion and our belief, as opposed to here, you know, Haman didn't really care about our belief. He just wanted to kill us all. It was more of a physical thing that gets manifested in many ways. The basic one is this one, that there is an obligation of a physical nature on Purim to eat and to do other physical things, which is a, you know, points out to that idea that this was a physical threat, and therefore we respond somewhat physically. Again, there's other interesting differences between the two, but we'll leave that for the moment. Now, in terms of, and that was how I titled the shiur, like prioritizing the mitzvot, so the truth is it's a pretty easy one. There's a Rambam in Hilchos Megillah in Perek Bet Halacha Yedzayin, where he says as follows. You don't have this in front of you. I'm just going to, actually, it actually is, part of it is in that paragraph on Matanos Le'avionim. You may not have the whole thing. I'll just read this. Mutav la'adam laharbos b'matanos le'avionim u'laharbos misu'udaso u'mishloach manos le'reyav. That's the end of the conversation. The shiur is over. Right? That it's better for a person to put his money towards matanos le'avionim than for his own personal su'uda or for the shloach manu. She'ein sham simcha gedola u'mefora elo l'smach le'ev aniyem v'yesomim v'almanos v'geirim. Right? Because there's no greater simcha than to provide and to give some simcha to those of the poor, orphans, widows, and geirim, etc. And so I think the first part, before we go into the details of these halachot, is that that's really the main thing. And unfortunately, sometimes in our society, sometimes things get put out of whack. But if every family has to determine whatever it is, the amount of money that they have, that they can afford, we'll talk about the minimums too, but how much money they can afford towards the holiday of Purim, so to speak, and then you should apportion it that way. So again, without doing the math, you know, the point is that you should put the majority of that money towards Matanot Le'avionim. That's what the Rambam's telling us, that, and we'll talk why in a few minutes, a little more of why this is, but that's what we should do when it comes to Matanot Le'avionim. Focus that money towards the poor. And again, I don't know about here, my first Purim in Toronto, but I know, unfortunately, New York, people end up putting a lot more money towards Mishloach Manot. I'm not saying more than Matanos Le'avionim. I don't know what other people give, but that's certainly the feel in some places. And I think oftentimes the rabbis talk about this, that you know, we should reapportion it the other way. Not that we shouldn't have a theme or whatever we want to do for Shalach Manot. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have any Shalach Manot or anything like that. But again, sometimes there's a tendency to go overboard, and going overboard often translates into more costly. If it doesn't, that's good. Okay, in terms of Matanot Le'avionim and Shalach Manot, so just let's talk about the basics, because this is often confused. And again, this is in the packet. So when it comes to Matanot Le'avionim, you have to give to two people, as opposed to Mishloach Manot, where you only have to give to one person, but you have to give them two items. That's where it sometimes gets confused, the two. So again, Matanot Le'avionim, you have to give money or food, clothing technically too, to two people. And Mishloach Manot, you only have to give one person two items. So let's go, so some of the basics in terms of how you fulfill Matanos Le'avionim. So, again, hopefully we don't have to be worried about the minimum, but at the same time, you know, you want to make sure that you've fulfilled that minimum. So, like, for example, if you were to just, hand a dollar to every poor person that you see on Purim, and that was the only thing you gave, that would not fulfill the mitzvah, because the point is that you have to give the person money that they can have at least have a basic meal for Purim. The whole purpose of it is to be able to give them money for Purim. If you want to give them extra for afterwards, that's beautiful too. But the basic essence is so that they should have the same simcha on Purim as you do. So the poskim that I've seen currently in the States say something like, and I don't mean any jokes about the Canadian dollar, but we would have to figure it out. It's not really about the Canadian dollar. It's more about how much it costs here. But basically, they literally talk about, like, how much does it cost to go, like, a bagel, a drink, something like that. Again, no bagels here in Toronto either, but we'll have to pick something else. But the point is, so there they talk about, like, $3 to $5. So again, whatever the equivalent here is, maybe add on a little bit, a drop more, I don't know, $5, whatever it is, that's the point that we have to make sure that we give two people at least that. Now, why is it that we all prepare, you know, dollars or quarters or whatever it is that we prepare to give out? Because there is a statement from Chazal that the Rambam talks about, that there's so much, and this is what we're going to focus the last part of the shiur in a few minutes, there's so much of an emphasis on this time of this holiday of trying to draw close to each other, of trying not to distinguish the different economic statuses of different people, that right, we don't hold back from giving tzedakah. Normally, if a guy shows up at your door, you don't know if he's worth, you know, if he's, you know, trustworthy. No mitzvah to give him tzedakah if you have a reason not to be sure. Right? On Purim, we say that we don't hold back, and anyone who puts out their hand, we give. So that's why the custom is oftentimes, whether it's a, you know, small dollar, you know, small quarters or whatever it might be, oftentimes there's this idea that we go out of our way just to give. But the point, just to make sure you do, is that that's not enough to fulfill the actual mitzvah. So again, that practice shouldn't change, but you should just make sure that at the very least you give that money to these two people. Has to be given to them on Purim, so you don't have to do that. You can do that through a shaliach. That's why, you know, many people give to the rabbi, the shul, or some other communal people who collect, who will then give it out on Purim day. And that's that is what one should do. When it comes to mishloach manot, so I'm not going to get too much involved into the details of what to give, just because, again, a lot of it's in that packet, and really, at the very basic, it's really not that difficult. It's really just two foods that are, and we'll see why in a minute, that are suitable to be given out at a meal. So they should be foods that are already cooked. I remember this is as a kid. I remember, you know, along the lines of themes. So someone gave out like a pizza theme. So it was a beautiful shaloch manos, but there wasn't one thing in the whole thing that was edible. Right? It was like a raw dough. It was like, you know, other stuff that you could put on to make a nice pizza, but nothing was edible. So it was a beautiful gift that somebody gave us, but they weren't, you would say, the mitzvah through it. Now again, remember, you only, to fulfill the mitzvah, have to give one person. So, you know, oftentimes we give many more than one person, so if we do those things, I just, you know, it's not like you're not going to be yotzei the mitzvah if you gave one person the right things, but again, it's important that we keep in mind, certainly for, you know, when we do want to make a big deal of this and educate our children about it, so it's important that we, you know, focus on making sure that what we're doing is actually showing them the way of fulfilling the mitzvah. No, so that's different. That is edible. Whether or not that, yeah, you know, that's why, again, like, you know, the, you know, if you want to do like the basic to fulfill the mitzvah, so often I see like, you know, just take like a challah roll and a little grape juice bottle or something like that. But technically with the candy stuff, I think you're technically yotzei. I would try to give one person, you know, a different one personally, but like, I don't think that's where you, I wouldn't, I think if, in terms of your children and them doing it, if that, that's technically considered edible. I don't know about your kids, but my kids probably eat more of that at the Suda anyway, so I think that's fine. I'm talking about as opposed to like non-edible items, you know, things that are not cooked yet, you know, things like that. Okay, in terms of the Suda of Purim, so I think there's three items that I'll just throw out here. The first one in this year is certainly not going to be difficult to achieve. In some years, perhaps it is. And that is that you're not supposed to start the meal until after chatzot, after midday. And you're supposed to have the majority of the meal before it gets dark. So again, this year with the clocks changed, I don't think that will be too much of a challenge because already it's going to be late. Probably most of us will finish before it's even dark, certainly if we have younger kids and things of that sort. But it is important to know because there are some times when it's not like this and sometimes people, you know, for whatever reasons are rushing around, and then they, you know, barely sit down to wash, you know, before sunset. So that's probably not the best practice. The best practice would be have at least the majority. Now, again, if you're, depends on how long your suda takes, will determine what your majority is. But the majority of the suda should take place during the daytime and not at night. Separate shir, which I invite everyone to come to on Sunday. I'm speaking at the Midrashet Yom Rishon at Eish as part of the cult, you know, the Wayu Midrashet Yom Rishon. We'll talk about a whole different concept that relates to, I think, one of the more important themes of Purim in terms of the notion of our connection to Torah and Kabbalah to Torah. So, but the connection here is that because there is such an important theme of learning Torah, even though it's always a mitzvah to learn Torah while you're having a seuda, it's even more of a reason on Purim to make sure that there's some Torah learning going on at the seuda. One of the things I always do is bridge that with the next halacha, which I'm going to be sending out an email also about either on Purim or the day after Purim. We know there's a big mitzvah called Shloshim Yom Kodem L'Chag, the 30 days before the Chag. Most poskim assume this only applies to the Chag of Pesach, but 30 days before Pesach is when you start to learn Hilchos Pesach, which 30 days before Pesach is Purim Day itself. So oftentimes at the Suda of Purim, I'll take out a Mishnah Berurah or something and we'll learn a little bit of Hilchos Pesach because that's the fulfillment of that mitzvah. In any event, I'm going to send out an email with some other interesting ways of trying to fulfill that concept of Shloshim Yom Kodem L'Chag. But at some point on Purim, it is a good idea to at least start the laws of Pesach. That's not to get anyone nervous about preparations and things of that sort, but find a good area that's not overwhelming to start to learn about. Okay. So now to take just a few minutes to hone in on Mishloach Manot. So I think a lot of what's going on in this time period, which goes to what I was referring to in terms of the togetherness and and trying to give to each other. So we know that the only reason that Haman had a chance, and the truth is, Chazal say he had a really good chance, right? It almost didn't happen that we got saved, was based on what the Megillah says, that we were an Am Mefuzar Umefurad, right? That we were, at that time, we were very divided. And we were not getting along so well with each other, which, again, not to get off track, that's, by the way, different from the story of Hanukkah time. That's why on Hanukkah it was just a few select people of the Hashemonaim who were able to save the Jews, as opposed to here, we needed Esther to gather everyone together on Tanis Esther to kind of do tshuva as a full community. We all had to come together because at the time we were not so together. So that plays itself out specifically in the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot. So there's a famous conversation, debate about, and it has some interesting ramifications. I don't know that any of these are going to happen to us every day or every year, but it's at least worth thinking about. But this is a famous conversation when it comes to the topic of Mishloach Manot. So what's the reason behind Mishloach Manot? Meaning, I understand everything else we've talked about, Matanos Levyonim, is obvious. We need to make sure everyone else is able to share in the Simcha. The Seuda is to, you know, as we talked about a little bit, the idea of physically showing that Hakaras HaTov to Hashem by the fact that He saved us physically, so we respond physically. But what exactly is it about Mishloach Manot? So the commentators give two vastly different reasons for why we give Shalach Manot, like what's behind it. So there's a famous Rishon by the name of the Truma HaJashin, and he basically says it's very simple. We give each other Mishloach Manot to make sure that we all have enough food for the Suda, or that we have food for the Suda. Right? And it's nothing more than that. It's just kind of like a mechanism to make sure that all of the Jewish people are able to have a Suda. So the obvious question then is, well, it should only apply the, so to speak, rich to give to the poor. Right, the rich people, and I don't mean just rich, but people who can afford to have a little bit of a suda, right, doesn't take that much, right? Sounds like they shouldn't have to do this. They should be able to be the ones to give, but they shouldn't need to be the recipients, right? So the poskim say that's a good question, but obviously if the whole purpose behind the Purim story that we've been talking about is to bring people together, that wouldn't be very good, and it would embarrass people. So therefore, we made sure that everybody gives each other, but really, the essence still is to make sure that we have enough food for a proper su'uda. That's opinion number one of the Truman Hadashah. There's another commentary by the name of the Manot HaLevi. He says, no, he says, according to this idea which we've been talking about, the whole purpose is just to engender peace and love and friendship, achva v'reyos, amongst Klal Yisrael, and therefore we give to each other, we give each other gifts, right? If you give someone a gift, right, who doesn't feel, you know, affection for the person when you get a good gift, right? So that's the idea of Mishloach Manot, that we want to make sure that we are going back and correcting that idea that we talked about of Am Mufuzar Mufura, that we're correcting that and that we're kind of coming together. So the truth is there are a bunch of interesting practical ramifications. Again, I don't know if this is going to impact us. I mean, technically one or two of them could, even if we don't think about it. So the first one, which hopefully won't happen, is what would be the halacha if I walk to your door on Purim and I give you a Mishloach Manot and you throw it back in my face and don't accept it? So am I yotzei the mitzvah by giving that Mishloach Manot? So that would depend on these two reasons, right? If the reason is a sign of friendship, now you may not have received my sign of friendship, right? But I've done the act to try to engender that, and therefore I would still be yotzei even though my Mishloach Manot is sitting on the floor. However, if the end goal is that you need to have more food at your suda, well, then that hasn't been accomplished, even though it wasn't my fault, right? You threw it back at me. So technically, I would suggest you go find someone else to give and that not be the only Mishloach Manot you give. That would be one possibility. This one, though, is more. So you might want to be careful about this. What happens if you give Mishloach Manot and the receiver doesn't know who gave it to them? Right, so you drop it off on someone's door, they're not home, and you didn't leave your name on it. Right, so that would be a good example. Right, so again, if the idea is to make sure that you are going to have food at your suda, you could argue, well, you're yotzei, I'm yotzei anyway, even though I gave you Mishloach Manot and you have no idea I gave it to you, but you still have the food, so I'm yotzei. If the idea is I'm supposed to engender friendship amongst us, well, I haven't accomplished that because you don't know that I'm the one who gave it to you. So, again, it would be recommended that you make sure that the recipient of your Mishloach Manot, yeah, put a card or whatever. Now, again, I just want to make it clear, even though these are, it's so hard to not be yotzei the mitzvah because we end up, I don't know, you know, whatever number of Mishloach Manot we give to many people, all you need is one good one, right, to be yotzei the mitzvah, right? So as long as you got one person who likes you and will receive your Mishloach Manot, and you put your name on one of them, so far you're still going to be okay. The other thing which we kind of touched on is if I am a millionaire and I come to your house with this little dinky Mishloach Manot, right, the little challah roll and grape juice bottle, right, so am I yotzei the mitzvah with that? So again, on the one hand, I'm giving you food for your suda, so that should work. On the other hand, right, if you view like my economic status as such that I can afford more than this little dinky thing, that may not be the best way to engender, you know, achva v'reya. So one could potentially argue in that case that you would not be yotzei as well, because again, it's not going to engender the achva v'reya. So again, that one I think is a little more questionable in practice. Again, I don't think that that's a reason for us to go out and spend, endlessly on Mishloach Manot, but I think there's a easy balance between, you know, overdoing it and not. So just to wrap up, the only thing that we really, that we didn't really touch on, which someone mentioned before we started, so I'll just mention it there, it's on page 2, there is a minhag, which it started from this past parsha. We, you know, we read parsha Shkalim, which was exactly this, about the machatzit shekel, which, by the way, ties into everything we've been talking about. And there's a lot of mefarshim on Chumash that talk about the idea that machatzit shekel for the Mishkan, rich or poor, everyone gave the exact amount. It's the same concept. It's not it's not an accident that we're reading this time of the year. The same idea here that we're contributing toward, and that was, by the way, the reason we read that now is because that was actually took place in the Mishkan in the month of Adar. That's when it happened. That's why we read it. But obviously, that all connects to this this idea. So you should give a half a shekel The custom is because in the Pasuk in the Chumash in Parashas Kisisa it says Truma three times. So the minhag is that we connect three half shkalim. Now again, there's no half dollar coin here, right? So I don't know exactly how people do it here. Again, in the States, there's half dollars that are not so used, like people don't use them too often, but they exist. So often what we'll do is you'll go into shul, and again, you don't have to do this in shul. You could do this in your own home. So it is advisable that women do it too. Again, a man could do it on behalf of another woman, and there's all kinds of interesting conversations about this, that a man should do it for his husband. If a woman is pregnant, the man should do it another one for the unborn child. An interesting conversation. How old should the child be that he has to do it on himself? Then I think the custom is that we assume that to do it for anyone above bat mitzvah, again, that doesn't mean they have to do it themselves. So, you know, someone in the family can act as a shliach for the others. So again, if you never did this before, it could be that your husband has done it on your behalf. And if not, this year you'll tell him to do so, or you'll find a way to do it to yourself. And oftentimes when you go into shul on Purim morning, or both Purim morning and before Megillah reading in the afternoon, like by Mincha time of Tanit Esther, so there'll be, you know, little boxes, pushkas, whatever, in different places in the shul. And again, this is the only part I don't know how we do here, because there they'll take three half dollars and like tape them together. So it's together, you lift it up, you say a little pasuk, that it's zeichel amachatid shekel. Again, this is a minhag. And then you throw the equivalent or a little bit more towards tzedakah, matanos levionim, into another box. So again, here exactly how we do it without a half dollar, I'm not sure. But either way, that is the notion. The only other thing which I would throw out there, and just again, when it comes to the laws of reading the Megillah, so that's obviously an important conversation. We read it twice, both at night and during the daytime. It's important to make sure that you hear the Megillah properly, every word. So you got to figure out when you have younger children how to do that properly, how to divide the times amongst you and your spouse in terms of when to go, so that everyone can do it properly. Happens to be, if anyone wants to join Purim morning, we have one here at 12 o'clock for staff, so that's a nice option. But again, there's some of the details that I think are important that I'm not going to take the time now to go through, but this review does go through some of the basic ones that you should keep in mind. I'm trying to see if there's anything here to add to. No. So I think with that, we will leave that out. And again, as I mentioned before, I'm going to be sending out an email, really two different emails, one on Purim Day, hopefully, which will have, similar to what I did on Hanukkah time, there will be, in the spirit of Shloshim Yom Kodem L'Chag, I have about, I think it's exactly 20, it's not all of Hilchos Pesach, but it's quite a bit of it. So if you want to learn that on your own time, kind of the way we did for Hanukkah, and I will be doing three or four shiurim like this the weeks from between Purim to Pesach, and hopefully one or two in the evening as well. The first one or two will probably be more Hilchot Pesach. The last two will be more Haggadah related. Thank you for coming. Have a wonderful day.